You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by MLB.tv. It's baseball everywhere.
Hey everyone, Tim McMaster taking you around the National League East for MLB.com Extras. And we start in the nation's capital where the Washington Nationals have righted the ship a bit. And we finally got to see the much anticipated Major League debut of Lucas Giolito, the number one prospect in all of baseball. So let's start in D.C. with our MLB.com Nationals reporter, Bill Ladson.
Bill, an exciting night on Tuesday night as Lucas Giolito makes his much-anticipated Major League debut, although they kind of threw some rain on it, literally. It was delayed the start of the game, so Giolito had to kind of wait it out a little bit, and then he only goes four innings because of an extended rain delay within the game. But those four innings, pretty good for Giolito as he goes four scoreless frames. He allowed a hit to the first batter, but then didn't allow another hit the rest of the way. He did walk a couple of batters, but overall, when you take into account everything that goes into a Major League debut, the attention, the nerves, all of that, you got to consider that a great start for Giolito, right?
He was great. He was outstanding. And what impressed me was his fastball, man. It was humming. And I got to tell you, he wasn't nervous at all. I mean, the first hit bat against Curtis Grandison was, it was obvious he gave up the hit there. But after that, he really settled down. And it was really telling how great the Nationals minor league system is, because it's pretty strong when you bring in a guy like that during the pennant race to really help out. And I don't think this is going to be his only start. I think there'll be more starts to come.
Yeah, and Giolito, obviously the number one prospect in all of baseball, and he got this start, obviously, because of an injury with Steven Strasburg going to the disabled list. But when he looked so good, and it was almost like a tease because you only got to see him for four innings, you got to believe we're going to see him again. The question is, when and how much pressure does Giolito's start on Tuesday put on Gio Gonzalez at the back end of this rotation?
That's a great question. You know, if you talk to Gio, you know, he believes he's pitching okay. He really believes that. And but I think, you know, it's not going to be long if Gio continues to struggle. I think we'll see Giolito in there. That's if, you know, Strasburg is healthy and comes back. So we'll wait and see.
Just a few days ago, things weren't looking great overall for this Nationals team as they went through their first extended losing streak of the year. They lost seven in a row. Everyone hits a skid at some point during the season, but they seem to have righted the ship now. Three in a row. They're 4.5 up on the Marlins, 5 up on the Mets, who they're obviously playing right now. And that was a benefit, I guess, for the Nationals of Tuesday night's game, is that Matt Harvey had to leave the game early as well, like Giolito. So things seem good, but the one dark cloud has been the back of Steven Strasburg. Obviously, that's why Giolito was in the game on Tuesday night. Strasburg scratched in back-to-back starts to the disabled list now. So what's the timetable now, Bill? Is there a timetable? Is there an idea of when he could get back and start another game for the Nationals?
No one really knows, per se. Now, he did have a bullpen session yesterday. That's great news. But I think we have to wait and see. I really believe that rest will really, really help Strasburg when it's all said and done. But so far, it's not serious. Nothing fractured inside, back, and it looks like he'll be okay for now, but we have, again, it's a wait and see.
I wonder if at this point it's maybe worth it to just kind of let him go straight through the All-Star break and then come back after the All-Star break and give him that little extra bonus rest. I'm assuming he's not, I mean, he's pitched at an All-Star level, no doubt, but I'm assuming he's not going to be pitching in San Diego.
No, I don't think he will be. You know, the Nationals are kind of careful when it comes to injuries like that. We've seen it with Jordan Zimmerman. You know, so again, when it comes to Strasburg, I think we have to wait and see if he can really go, you know, right before the All-Star break. I don't think he will, but we'll see.
Anthony, every week we do this podcast, and every week there's a new injury as far as the Mets go. It started with the position players, and now he's certainly moved into the rotation with the injuries. And the big deal this week, obviously, is the bone spurs, and apparently it's I don't know. It multiplies. Steven Matz with the bone spurs in his elbow. Noah Syndergaard now with the bone spurs in his elbow. As of now, both guys are going to try to pitch through it. Do you think in your mind this is something that these two guys can play with and pitch with the rest of this season before surgery?
Yeah, you know, these two injuries keep getting grouped together, Steven Matz and Noah Syndergaard, and that probably shouldn't be the case. Steven Matz has a pretty sizable one in the back of his elbow, and it's been causing him quite a bit of irritation when he's been pitching, when he's been on the mound, and it is all but a guarantee that he is going to need to open up that elbow at some point surgically to remove it. Now, the Mets hope that he can make it through this season, that he can wait until November for them to go out there and do that arthroscopic surgery and take the bone spur out. But that's going to depend upon how Steven Matz feels. He's on some anti-inflammatories, which aim to sort of ease the tissue irritation around the spur so that he won't be feeling as much pain. But it's all going to be a matter of pain management for him. Noah Syndergaard, while the injury is the same, his bone spur is much, much smaller, and he is not feeling nearly the degree of discomfort that Steven Matz is. So the proposition for Noah Syndergaard to get through this season without having it removed and without feeling too much discomfort is much, much easier for him to stomach. Really, there's a decent chance that he won't even need surgery at all, at least not anytime soon to get it removed. Now, these things can grow over time. They don't always, and certainly years down the road, that might happen in Noah Syndergaard's case, and he might need to get his elbow opened up. But I think on the surface, while these two injuries are pretty similar, what they portend for the Mets is quite different in that Steven Matz is going to have a lot more trouble pitching through this than Noah Syndergaard will.
Now, Noah Syndergaard didn't look like he was at his best on Monday. Is there any connection between the bone spur and his struggle, or is it just, hey, he had a rough start after a run of dominance?
Well, talking to some people around the Mets, I mean, it sounds like the only connection was that Noah Syndergaard might have been overthrowing a little bit, overcompensating, just because he wanted to prove that he was healthy. We've seen that before from Noah Syndergaard. We've seen it from Matt Harvey. When things have swirled around these guys, they just go out and you know, let it loose in the hopes of kind of shutting everybody up, for lack of a better phrase. And I think there was a little bit of that with Noah Syndergaard the other night. He was throwing one-on-one, and the velocity was all there and then some, but the command left a lot to be desired. So I think Noah Syndergaard realizes that he needs to maybe dial it back a little bit and learn to pitch at something less than 100% so that we're not looking at those situations in the future. There's also a little mental aspect, I think, with anyone who knows there's something going on inside their arms, inside their elbows, to get past that mentally and just say, hey, you know what, the doctors told me I couldn't do any more damage, so I'm going to let it loose and let it fly and let it rip. I don't think it's going to be a huge issue for Noah Syndergaard going forward, but certainly there might have been some of that the other night when the Nationals beat him up pretty good.
Before those two bone spur situations came about, the big news of the week obviously was going back to the weekend, Anthony and Jose Urias officially becoming a part of the Mets again as he heads to the minor leagues. He started off in Brooklyn on Sunday and Monday as the Mets try to do something to help out this lineup and help out this infield. At this point, what's the timetable for Reyes? And from my standpoint, we thought maybe there'd be a little backlash. I haven't really seen that.
No, you know, I'll answer the second part first. There hasn't been a ton. And I think when they were in the process of signing him, because it became such an inevitability before it actually happened, those who were very opposed to it sort of got out what they had to say at that time. And since then, Jose Reyes has pretty much been embraced, certainly by the people in Brooklyn who saw his debut. And, you know, now he's playing a road game in Altoona. And I think there's going to be more of it. Certainly he's going to have to answer those questions again once he gets to New York. You know, once he goes to other stadiums around the league, I think people might have a little more say publicly against him. And I think Jose realizes that, and I think he actually said it best before his first game in Brooklyn, when he said, look, I made a mistake. I own up to it. I apologize to the Mets and to everyone before I signed here. And what I found really interesting that he said was, he said, you know, I think I realize that there's going to be a portion of the population that will never, ever forgive me. And I totally get that. And I totally respect their right to do so, but I feel that I deserve a second chance. So I think he's saying all the right things, and that's not going to be a huge issue going forward, despite the fact that obviously, you know, it's something that's going to follow Jose Reyes around for the rest of his life. To answer the first part of your question, there is no timeline right now, and Jose Reyes has been pretty open lines of communication with the people up here in New York, saying, look, I want to be ready when I come. I don't want to just come because you guys are struggling on offense. I don't want to just come because I want to be in the big leagues. I want to make sure that when I get there, I'm ready to contribute and be, you know, what we all know that Jose Reyes can be. So first three minor league games haven't gone great. He's 0 for 9 at the plate. He committed a fielding error on a pretty easy play, from what I understand, talking to people who saw it happen. So it could be a little bit. He's going to be with Binghamton for the duration now. He's going to play a lot of third base, and they've got a pretty sizable homestand coming up after two games in Altoona in Western Pennsylvania. And I think he might spend most, if not all, of that homestand in AA getting prepared so that maybe another week down the line here we're looking at a debut with the Mets in New York.
Todd, as we record this podcast, suddenly the Phillies are red hot. They sweep the Diamondbacks, and they do it in exciting fashion. On Wednesday, they get the 10-inning win. The winning run comes in on a sac fly, but nonetheless, they win in extras. Tuesday night, they win late, walk-off walk by Ryan Howard. And then Monday, and the game that I kind of want to focus on more than those other two, they win 8-0 because Vince Velasquez is tremendous in his return from the disabled list. And let's start there. Five innings, so he only goes five, but he allows obviously five scoreless, five hits. He strikes out seven in that stretch, and he goes to 6-2 on the season. Was there a reason he only went five? Because he was at 84 pitches. Was it just a matter of his first time back off the DL? They want to ease him back in as far as pitch count goes?
Yeah, that's exactly it. They had him on a pitch count right around there. You know, they kind of get a feel for how the game is going. But they want to be very, very, very careful with Vince Velasquez for the rest of the season, not only because he's coming back from an injury, even though everybody, by all accounts, says it wasn't that serious, but because he's never thrown more than 124 innings in a season, so they were going to be careful with him even before the injury, and also because they had some durability concerns, injury concerns with him when they made that trade with Houston in December. So you put all those things together, and they're just not going to go out there and really, truly turn him loose. In fact, really the rest of the season, I would be surprised if he threw 115, 120 pitches in a game the rest of the year. Now, not to say it couldn't happen. This is just my own personal opinion. But they just want to be careful with him because he is such a key piece to this team's future. We've seen his talent. We've seen how much he can dominate. And they just don't want to go to a situation where they start having to go out there and throw 7-8 innings, start after start after start, suffers another injury, and boy, you know, what were we thinking? We're rebuilding. We really don't need him to go crazy this year. We want him to go guns blazing, you know, next season and beyond.
So, yeah, great stuff out of Velasquez. You look at the rest of the rotation, not as positive right now. Adam Morgan moved out of the rotation. He was just 1-6 with a 6.55 ERA, so obviously the struggles were there. And I guess he's never actually pitched out of a bullpen, so that's certainly going to be interesting. And then there's Aaron Nola, who's obviously kind of suffering through the first real bump in the road as far as his career goes. What is the thought about Morgan as a bullpen arm?
You know, I think what they're hoping there is that his stuff will play up a little bit better in you know, kind of shorter doses. You know, they are going to use him as a long man, I guess, but they just think he's got four pretty good pitches. He hasn't shown up in the rotation this season, although he did pitch pretty effectively out of the rotation last season, or I should say competently out of the rotation last season. I think they're just hoping that maybe a different look, maybe just facing a team one time around, maybe allowing him to kind of let loose a little bit, maybe kind of pick up his velocity a little bit, will help him pitch with a little bit more success. I was a little surprised at the move only because, you know, hey, while he has struggled this year, like I said, last year he had an ERA of about 4.5 after 16 starts, which isn't great, but when you're a rebuilding team and you know how much pitchers can get injured, starting pitchers can get injured, he's a nice guy to have in your back pocket. if a need should arise. But that's kind of what they're thinking about right now.
And what is going on with Nola? Because it's been smooth sailing, really, from draft day, basically, until now. You know you're going to face at some point a need to adjust and that kind of thing. But he got off to such a good start this year, I felt like maybe he had even dodged that. But now he's finally kind of regressing a little bit.
Yeah, you know, it's crazy. You mentioned that he's been kind of smooth sailing since he's drafted. I mean, really, smooth sailing since the beginning of his life. And this is really like the first time ever, if you think about it. This is literally the first time ever in his entire life he's ever faced any adversity pitching-wise. Not in high school, not really in college, not through the minor leagues, not through about his first 20, 25 starts in the big leagues. These last four starts are pretty much it. And I think it's a couple things. One, his mechanics are just out of whack. You know, he's talked a lot about he's kind of not finishing his pitches. He's not releasing the ball with his hands on top of the ball. It's a little bit off to the side. So he's kind of cutting off his fastball, cutting off his pitches that are a little bit flatter. They have a little bit less bite, and they're a lot less effective. And then also, for a guy like Aaron Nola, his whole thing, his whole calling card is command. And he doesn't walk anybody. He doesn't hit batters. He hit three batters over the weekend in San Francisco. And that is so not Aaron Nola. So clearly he's got some mechanical issues going on right now. But I think the other thing also is battling his confidence. You know, I talked to Carlos Ruiz after a game on Sunday in San Francisco, and he says, yeah, I can see, you know, his confidence is down a little bit. Pete McCann said after the game, you know, he looks a little confused out there, which is understandable. Like I said, he's never, ever struggled at any level before. And now after
Mark, the Braves, you know, struggles continue, obviously, on the field, but there's a lot of other things to talk about, some positive things to talk about as far as the schedule goes. The All-Star game's coming up. The Futures game is coming up, and that should be something Braves fans might want to tune into. But let's start on the field. They've run into an Indians team that came in red hot and has certainly stayed that way. But Matt Whistler was good on Tuesday night. The bullpen couldn't get it done, but a positive start from Matt Whistler.
No doubt. And you know what? These last three starts have all been as encouraging from a developmental standpoint as any that Matt has made this year. He's been more efficient at different points this season. But in each start, he struggled with his command early on. The first three innings have been his problem. He's issued eight walks in the first three innings of these past three starts and hasn't issued any walks, you know, from the fourth through the seventh inning in any of them. But What I'm seeing from Whistler is a guy who was able to make quick adjustments. And that is one of those final steps in the developmental standpoint. Here we are about 35 starts into his career. He's a very cerebral pitcher. And I think what we saw, his ability to make the turnaround late last year, that was a sign of his ability to, you know, not give in to struggles and just give up for the rest of the season after he went to the bullpen. But at the same time, I think the more important thing is these in-game adjustments that he's made from a mechanical and standpoint, and also just as simply his approach. These past three starts, while the early innings have been rocky, the way he has finished has provided some encouragement that he's still moving in the right direction.
So that's good news for the rotation. Bad news, John Gant placed on the disabled list, left oblique strain. Obviously, he's a guy who the question's still out there whether or not he's a starter or a reliever long term. But opens the door up Wednesday. We're going to see the major league debut of Joel De La Cruz. What do you expect to see from him? What kind of a ceiling does he have as a player coming up from the minors?
Well, you know, he's 27 years old. He was in the Yankee system for so long. I think what we're seeing is a guy who has just pitched very effectively over the last month at the Triple-A level. They really didn't have anyone else left. They're probably going to bring Mike Polsinevich back one day or one start earlier than expected to pitch on Thursday. I don't think we would have ever seen De La Cruz had they not lost three starters to the disabled list and then also a losing Aaron Blair back to the minors this month. So at the end of May, I think you and I talked, I was talking about how great this rotation was shaping up. This has been a rough month for the rotation, yet they've won more games this month than they had the previous two. But I think right now what we're seeing is, you know, obviously that's a product of Julio Teheran continuing to extend his dominance over the last 2 months. Bud Norris coming in and providing some unexpected stability. Matt Whistler, like you said, those have been the important developments of this month. Seeing a guy like De La Cruz, I think you're going to see him for maybe a start or two, maybe at least until they feel that Aaron Blair is ready to come back. Like I said, Fulty will slip in there. They're probably on Thursday. And then so there will still be some semblance of what they had at the end of May there with Whistler, Fulty, and Teheran providing, you know, some indication of what this rotation may look like in the future.
Great opportunity coming up this weekend, Mark. Fort Bragg will be the site as the Braves and Marlins go head-to-head. And it's the first regularly scheduled neutral site game on U.S. soil. That's a lot of words there. Since way back in 1997, I think, when the Padres played out in Hawaii. So it's pretty cool, and it's even cooler that it's happening on a military base. People that don't know, they actually built a Major League Stadium, a temporary stadium right there on Fort Bragg. I think it holds around 13,000 or 14,000. They're going to play this game on Sunday Night Baseball on ESPN, and the crowd is just going to be pretty much just military and troops, and it's a really neat thing. And I know you've gotten a chance to talk to a lot of the Braves players about this opportunity. It's obviously going to be tough schedule-wise with the added travel, and then they got to get away after that. But there seems to be no complaints at all about this. All these players, both teams, seem thrilled and excited to be going to Fort Bragg.
Yeah, I think so. I certainly haven't heard any complaints, and I thought Jeff Francoeur said it best. He said, you know, I know these troops are really excited to see a big league game, but I think we are more excited to sit down, interact with them, see what they do, get it, you know, see the base. There will be a lot of activity on Sunday. These two teams will leave Atlanta Saturday night, get to North Carolina, sleep, and then wake up and have a full day of interacting with the troops, touring the base. And I think it will be. It'll be a fun day all around. And as Jeff said, you know, it's somewhat humbling anytime they go to any of these bases across the country where, you know, when they go to San Diego, they go and visit Navy SEALs and stuff. He says it's humbling because we think that we grind and you look at what they do. And he said these guys run circles around us based on what everything that they sacrifice and do on a daily basis.
Joe, the Marlins continue to play good baseball, and they hit the Cubs at a good time. I guess you can look at it two ways. The Cubs seem like they're struggling a little bit, but Marlins playing good baseball, maybe they're the reason for that. Either way, the Marlins take 3 of 4 from a team that most people say is the best team in baseball right now, or certainly in the National League. And Sunday, Jose Fernandez rises to the occasion against a lineup that's obviously powerful with this Cubs team, and he gets it done again, and it seemed like a kind of an exclamation point as we head towards the All-Star break for Jose Fernandez to shut down a Cubs lineup.
Oh, yeah, yes, and it's, you know, you can't really take anything away. They beat Lester, they beat Lackey, and then they win their Jose game. So, I'm not taking anything away from a shorthanded Cubs team. The Marlins are playing really well, and they're doing what the teams are doing. They're playing against anybody and holding their own. And I think they've proven all year they could play with the best in the National League. They went out to L.A., swept the Dodgers 4 there. They've won at Washington. They've won at New York. They beat Pittsburgh 3 of 4. And at homestand, they took 3 of 4 from the Rockies as well. So this is a team that's kind of hitting its stride right now. They're getting contributions from an awful lot of people. Stanton's starting to wake up, and that's obviously a really good sign for the Marlins. Back into the bullpen remains really, really good. And, if Adam Conley and Wei-Yin Chen pitch like they did in their last starts, and Tom Kohler's been solid, they got 4 really good starting pitchers. So a lot of things are lining up, and I still think it's a team that hasn't played its best baseball yet.
Yeah, and Stanton, you mentioned heating up and coming through with big hits, too. It was good to see on Friday a couple big hits against the Cubs. You mentioned 4 solid starters. I guess if there's any question mark on this team right now, it's a fifth starter, but that's true of pretty much every team in baseball. But when you look at the Marlins situation at that 5-hole, they signed Jeremy Guthrie to a minor league deal. I don't know what that means. He's a guy that who knows what's left. Who's the best option to fit that fifth role? I know you wrote a couple weeks ago about internal options Austin Bryce, Luis Castillo. Where do the Marlins go with that number five starter?
Yeah, I think they may just go right back to Justin Nicolino.
Yep.
Nicolino's down in AAA. He's made a couple of really good starts. Paul Clemens is obviously a stopgap guy right now. That's, you know, a guy that they had in spring training with him, a guy with a little bit of experience a couple of years ago in the big leagues with Houston. And, you know, he's the type of guy that maybe will slide into depth as a reliever at some point if he gets sent back down. Austin Bryce is at AA. He probably will get a AAA call up at some point. He's already kind of working out of the pen right now because I think they look at him as a second half bullpen piece. And fifth starters, you know, like you said, Jeremy Guthrie is a guy they're just taking a flyer on to see if there's anything left. And he signed a minor league deal. It's a low risk, obviously, type of signing. He still has to pass his physical, when assuming he does that. He goes to AAA if he shows anything. He obviously has pitched in the big leagues and has a track record. So he kind of falls in, and I anticipate they're going to try to swing a trade between now and August 1st. And the question is, can they do something without taking somebody off their big league rosters, which is what they really do not want to do.
Yeah, that's why one of the reasons you have prospects, I guess, is to make a deal like this once you're in contention. And the Marlins are showing right now, I think, that they're in it to stick this year, and they will be buyers. It'll be interesting. Big game coming up for the Marlins. They take on the Braves at Fort Bragg down in North Carolina, Joe, and it's kind of a neat thing for Major League Baseball. It's historic. There's a lot of levels here. First time that they're going to play a real Major League Baseball game on a base like that. They basically built a Major League stadium at Fort Bragg, and if you've seen the video on MLB.com, it's fascinating how they built up the stadium, and it's pretty much going to be just troops and military people that'll be at the game watching the Marlins take on the Braves. I know you've gotten a chance to talk to lots of the players about this experience. What have you gotten a sense for being what players are most looking forward to?
I'm just kind of amazed, and amazed might be the wrong word, but there's just so much excitement. You know, baseball is such a grind and such a daily routine, and players kind of, you know, try to keep that levelness no matter where they're going. But there's really a genuine excitement to a man about going to Fort Bragg, and it's going to be obviously tough travel because they're just going to kind of fly into Atlanta and get out of there, get to Fort Bragg, and then play a 4 o'clock, play Sunday night game in Fort Bragg, and then play 4 o'clock at New York on 4th of July. So, you know, a lot of stuff that could be looked at as a distraction. Instead, it's like kind of the theme of the players is no matter what hardships they go through, the military and those, you know, men and women who serve this country so well, that they do more. You know, their day starts a little earlier. They're asked to do things a little more grueling and with a lot more at stake. So I think there's a real appreciation for this trip. There's, like I said, genuine excitement. I know I'm looking forward to going as well because no one really knows what to expect. You know, the player's going to have, I guess, a block of time in the morning to get in. They got, a 4 or 5 o'clock game on Saturday at Atlanta. We'll head to Fort Bragg immediately after. In that morning, they have a 4-hour block where they're going to, you know, go around the base and, you know, meet with the troops, kind of get a little feel of what their day is like. And that should be very exciting. And then just to see how the game's, you know, pulled off, the logistics of it, or, you know, how that field's going to play. And like you say, there's just going to be in the audience there in the stands, I think it's 12,500, 13,000, whatever, is going to be military personnel and their families. So obviously it's going to be a very unique atmosphere, and tied around the 4th of July weekend will just add to the flavor of patriotism and just kind of they're really celebrating the 4th in a very interesting way, in a way I think if they pull this off, it could be a tradition for years to come.